This CLE is based on the appellate decisions addressing civil procedure released by our appellate courts in July of 2019. The summaries of these decisions were originally posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in July 2019, and they've subsequently been collected into a July 2019 civil procedure pamphlet. And it's that pamphlet that constitutes the written materials for this CLE. And the page references are to that pamphlet. The first case is on page 8. It's C.H. versus Dolkart. And it has to do with the appealability of a motion in limine. Third Department held that the defendant doctor could not appeal the denial of defendant's motion to limit the expert testimony which plaintiff could offer at trial in a medical malpractice action. The motion court's ruling did not limit the issues to be tried. Therefore, an appeal must be brought after trial. The court wrote, "It's well settled that an order which merely determines the admissibility of evidence, even when made in advance of trial on motion papers, constitutes, at best, an advisory opinion, which is neither appealable as of right nor by permission. Here, Supreme Court's decision merely permits the infant to offer various testimony of his expert witnesses and does not limit the scope of the issues to be tried. Therefore, appellate review of the court's ruling must await the conclusion of trial so that the relevance of the proffered evidence and the effect of the court's ruling can be assessed in the context of the record as a whole. Accordingly, this appeal must be dismissed." The next case on pages 9 and 10, matter of Buffalo Council of Supervisors. It has to do with an Article 78 petition that was verified by an attorney. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the verification of an Article 78 petition by petitioner's attorney was valid because the attorney had firsthand knowledge of the contents. And even if the verification was invalid, the respondent had waived any objection to it. The court wrote, "Although the verification requirement of CPLR 7804D must ordinarily be completed by a party, a verification may be made by a party's attorney, whereas here, all the material allegations of the pleading are within the personal knowledge of that attorney. Moreover, a party challenging the sufficiency of a verification is required to give notice with due diligence to the attorney of the adverse party that he or she elected to treat the petition as a nullity. Thus, even assuming arguendo that the verification by petitioner's attorney was insufficient, we conclude that respondents waived any challenge to the petition on that ground by failing to make the requisite diligent efforts and instead waiting a month before seeking dismissal of the petition on that basis." Next is a matter of Hagen on page 10. It's another Article 78 case. This time, the prosecutor in a criminal case attempted to bring an Article 78 prohibition action against the judge because the prosecutor disagreed with a decision in the criminal case that excluded certain evidence. Third Department held that the Article 78 proceeding brought by the district attorney against the trial judge in a criminal case seeking prohibition should have been dismissed. The trial judge had ruled that the conversations between an attorney and the defendant at the scene of the crime were protected by attorney-client privilege. The court said, "Petitioner's core complaint is that respondent erred in determining the scope of that privilege, and she may be correct. Nevertheless, prohibition will not lie as a means of seeking collateral review of mere trial errors of substantive law or procedure, however egregious the error may be, and however cleverly the error may be characterized by counsel as an excess of jurisdiction or power." Next, on page 11, it's matter of Acadia Site Construction. It's another Article 78 case dealing with the jurisdiction of an appellate court to hear an Article 78. Third Department held it did not have subject matter jurisdiction, and therefore the Article 78 petition seeking review of the disqualification of a bid on a construction project must be denied. The appellate division by statute has jurisdiction only after an administrative hearing. Here, petitioner's request for a hearing was denied. Next case is on page 12, Marina Distribution Development Company. It has to do with the requirement that an attorney practicing in New York have an office in New York. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that using a virtual law office program, which is abbreviated to VLOP, using a VLOP only as a mailing address and as an agent to accept service in New York is not enough to satisfy the judiciary law requiring an attorney practicing in New York to have a physical office in New York. The court went on to find, however, that the action started by the attorney with the virtual law office was not, as the Supreme Court held, a nullity, so the action could go forth. Next is Jean Paul case on page 13. It has to do with the failure to disclose a personal injury action in a bankruptcy proceeding. Second Department held plaintiff did not have the legal capacity to sue in a slip and fall case because the action was not listed as an asset in the prior bankruptcy proceeding. The court wrote, the failure of a party to disclose a cause of action as an asset in a prior bankruptcy proceeding, which the party knew or should have known existed at the time of that proceeding, deprives him or her of the legal capacity to sue subsequently on that cause of action. Next is the Delmore case on page 14. It's a spoliation case, which held that the striking of the complaint was an appropriate sanction. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the destruction of plaintiff's truck, which was allegedly in a collision with defendant's truck, warranted striking the complaint. The court wrote, on their motion pursuant to CPLR 3126 to strike the complaint, the defendants sustained their burden of establishing that the plaintiff was obligated to preserve the truck at the time it was purportedly seized and disposed of, that the truck had been seized and disposed of before the defendants had an opportunity to inspect it, and that the truck was relevant to the litigation. Furthermore, the defendants demonstrated that their ability to prove their defense had been significantly, if not fatally, compromised by the loss of the truck. Under the circumstances, the sanction of striking the complaint was appropriate. Next is the Labuda case on page 16. It has to do with the filing of two complaints arising out of the same action. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that dismissal of the second complaint arising out of the same facts as the first complaint filed 2 months earlier was not required. Plaintiff had hired new counsel 13 days before the statute of limitations ran out. The first complaint mentioned both intentional and negligent conduct. The second complaint fleshed out the specific intentional torts. The court wrote, CPLR 3211, subdivision A4, does not require a trial court to dismiss an action upon the ground that another similar action is pending, instead allowing it to make such order as justice requires. The purpose of the defense of the pendency of another action between the same parties for the same cause is to prevent a party from being harassed or burdened by having to defend a multiplicity of suits. In our view, the reasons stated by plaintiff for commencing this action rather than moving for leave to amend the first complaint are not so clearly inadequate that dismissal was required to serve that purpose. Whereas here, relief is required under CPLR 3211A4 to correct similar pending actions, consolidation or joint trial is permissible, and in many many instances preferable to dismissal. And then I added a note here, which is based on another case from the Second Department, that it may have been possible for the plaintiff to file a copy of the proposed supplemental summons with a motion to amend the complaint, which would have told the statute of limitations. And the name of that case is Karagiannis, that's Karagiannis, versus North Shore Long Island Jewish Health System. It's at 83rd, that's 80 AD 3rd, page 569. It's a Second Department case from 2011, and the site obviously is on page 16. Next is Matter of Solomon on page 17. It has to do with the continuing wrong doctrine. Second Department held that the continuing wrong doctrine did not toll the statute of limitations in this employee-employer dispute about a health insurance premium contribution. The petitioner unsuccessfully argued each paycheck with the premium deduction was an independent wrong which tolled the statute of limitations. The court wrote, "An administrative determination regarding payment of salary or pay adjustments is final and binding, and a challenge thereto accrues when the petitioner receives a check or salary payment reflecting the administrative determination. Contrary to the petitioner's contention, the continuing wrong doctrine does not apply here to toll the statute of limitations. The doctrine may only be predicated on continuing unlawful acts and not on the continuing effects of an earlier unlawful conduct. The distinction is between a single wrong that has continuing effects, as here, and a series of independent, distinct wrongs." Next is the Etzion case, which is on page 18. It deals with the continuous representation doctrine in the context of legal malpractice. The First Department held the continuous representation doctrine did not apply and the legal malpractice action was time-barred. Plaintiff was represented by defendant law firm in a 2005 divorce. Plaintiff's ex-wife then sued plaintiff, alleging he fraudulently concealed an asset in the divorce proceedings. Defendant law firm successfully defended the fraud action. 12 years after the divorce action ended, plaintiff sued the law firm for malpractice, asking to be relieved of the obligation to pay the law firm's legal fees in the fraud action. The court wrote, "The motion court correctly found that this action, which was commenced 12 years after the divorce action ended, is barred by the applicable 3-year statute of limitations. Contrary to plaintiff's contentions, the continuous representation doctrine is inapplicable because defendants were retained under 2 separately executed retainer agreements in the divorce action and the fraud action. The first retainer agreement expressly stated that it did not cover any services following the entry of a final judgment of divorce. Thus, there was no mutual understanding that further representation was necessary on the specific subject matter of the malpractice claim." Next is the Leader case on pages 19 and 20. It's another continuous representation doctrine case in the context of legal malpractice, this time with the opposite result. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff had raised a question of fact whether the continuous representation doctrine told the statute of limitations in this legal malpractice action. The attorney had attempted to remedy the failure to file objections in an estate matter after the statute had run. The court wrote, "Defendant met his burden by establishing that the statute of limitations for legal malpractice is 3 years, that's CPLR 214 subdivision 6, that the estate cause of action accrued on November 1, 2010, the last date on which to file objections to the accounting, and that the estate cause of action was therefore untimely when this malpractice action was commenced on November 15th, 2013. The burden then shifted to plaintiff to raise a tribal issue of fact whether the statute of limitations was told by the continuous representation doctrine. We agree with plaintiff that the court erred in determining that plaintiff failed to do so. It's well settled that in order for the continuous representation doctrine to apply, there must be clear indicia of an ongoing, continuous, developing, and dependent relationship between the client and the attorney, which often includes an attempt by the attorney to rectify an alleged act of malpractice. Here, plaintiff submitted evidence that defendant made several unsuccessful attempts to file the objections within the weeks after the deadline, and that he made preparations to appear at a scheduled conference on the objections on November 23, 2010. Those efforts could be viewed as attempts by the attorney to rectify an alleged act of malpractice, and thus plaintiff raised a tribal issue of fact whether the statute of limitations was told by the continuous representation doctrine. Next is the Engelhaus or Engelhaus case on page 20. This is a continuous treatment doctrine case in the context of medical malpractice. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the medical malpractice action based upon a 2005 thyroid surgery by the same doctor who performed a 2010 thyroid surgery was time-barred. The two surgeries were discrete events, and the statute of limitations was not told by the continuous treatment doctrine. The doctor's name was Chaffee, C-H-A-H-F-E. The court wrote, "It is undisputed that plaintiff did not treat with Dr. Chaffee in relation to the 2005 surgery after her final follow-up appointment in 2005, and that she did not return to Dr. Chaffee until 2010. The surgical procedures in 2005 and 2010 were discrete and complete events that cannot be linked by way of the continuous treatment doctrine, and there was no evidence of anticipated further treatment related to the 2005 procedure at the time plaintiff left Dr. Chaffee's care in 2005. Next is the Donahue case on page 21. It deals with the adequacy of a notice of claim in a case brought in the Court of Claims. Fourth Department affirmed the award of money damages to claimant for personal injury. The claim did not specifically request lost wages as damages. The majority held the claim was not jurisdictionally deficient, and the specific items of damage need not have been spelled out. That's in the notice of claim. The dissenter disagreed and argued the award for lost wages should be vacated. The court said, "Here, claimant sufficiently specified the nature of the claim, the time, when, and the place where the claim arose, and the injuries claimed to have been sustained, that being injuries to his shoulder, bicep, and elbow. Inasmuch as this is an action for damages for personal injury, claimant was not required to specify, in total or itemized by category, his claimed items of damage. Damages sought by claimant for medical expenses or lost wages are matters for the bill of particulars." Next is the Katan case, or Katan case, K-A-T-A-N. It's another case dealing with the adequacy of a notice of claim in an action brought in the Court of Claims. Third Department held that claimant in this slip and fall case did not meet the pleading requirements of Court of Claims Act Section 11, and her claim was therefore properly dismissed. Although claimant submitted an aerial map in opposition to the motion to dismiss to show where the slip and fall took place, only the information in the claim needed to be considered by the court. The court wrote, "Court of Claims Act Section 11B provides that the claim shall state the place where such claim arose. Although absolute exactness is not required, a claimant must provide a sufficiently detailed description of the particulars of the claim to enable defendant to investigate and promptly ascertain the existence and extent of its liability. Defendant is not required to ferret out or assemble information that Court of Claims Act Section 11B obligates the claimant to allege, and failure to abide by the statute's pleading requirements constitutes a jurisdictional defect mandating dismissal of the claim, even though this may be a very harsh result. In opposition to the motion to dismiss, claimant submitted an aerial map of where she allegedly fell. However, the aerial map does not cure the pleading defect in her claim because the aerial map was not included in her claim, and defendant is not required to go beyond the claim to ascertain the situs of the injury. Next is Bank of New York Mellon. It's on page 23. It has to do with a motion to vacate default. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that law office failure was an adequate excuse, and appellant's motion to vacate a default judgment should have been granted in this foreclosure action. The court said, the appellant's attorney explained that upon receiving the plaintiff's motion, he directed his office's legal assistants to note the return date of the motion on the office calendar, but that the return date had not been noted on the calendar. In addition, the appellants demonstrated a potentially meritorious defense based upon the statute of limitations. So law office failure and a meritorious defense allowed the bank to vacate the default in this foreclosure case. Next is HSBC Bank USA. It's on page 24. It has to do with the motion for a default judgment in a foreclosure action. The Second Department determined plaintiff bank's motion for a default judgment in the foreclosure action should not have been granted. The court wrote, with regard to default judgments, CPLR 3215C provides that if the plaintiff fails to take proceedings for the entry of a judgment within 1 year after the default, the court shall not enter judgment, but shall dismiss the complaint as abandoned, without costs, upon its own initiative or on motion. The one exception to the otherwise mandatory language of CPLR 3215C is that the failure to timely seek a default on an unanswered complaint may be excused if sufficient cause is shown why the complaint should not be dismissed. This court has interpreted this language as requiring both a reasonable excuse for the delay in timely moving for a default judgment, plus a demonstration that the cause of action is potentially meritorious. Whereas here, a party moving for a default judgment beyond 1 year from the date of default fails to address any reasonable excuse for its untimeliness, courts may not excuse the lateness and shall dismiss the claim pursuant to CPLR 3215C. In another case involving the same abandonment issue on pages 24 and 25, it's also an HSBC Bank USA case. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the plaintiff bank had abandoned the foreclosure action by failure to move for a default judgment within 1 year. The bank's participation in mandatory settlement conferences did not constitute the initiation of an action for a default judgment. The court said, CPLR 3215C provides, if plaintiff fails to take proceedings for the entry of judgment within 1 year, the court shall not enter a judgment, but shall dismiss the complaint as abandoned without costs upon its own initiative or upon a motion. The language of CPLR 3215C is not discretionary but mandatory, inasmuch as courts shall dismiss claims for which default judgments are not sought within the requisite 1 year period, as those claims are deemed abandoned. However, the failure to timely seek a default judgment may be excused if sufficient cause is shown why the complaint should not be dismissed. To establish sufficient cause required by CPLR 3215C, a plaintiff must proffer a reasonable excuse for the delay in timely moving for a default judgment and demonstrate that it has a potentially meritorious action. Here, the plaintiff took no steps to initiate proceedings for the entry of a default judgment against the appellant. The plaintiff's participation in the mandatory foreclosure settlement part conferences did not constitute the initiation of proceedings for an entry of a default judgment. Next is the Wells Fargo case, pages 25 and 26, another foreclosure action. Here the bank made a timely motion pursuant to CPLR 3215C to vacate the default, but the appellate court held that the bank's failure to appear at a scheduled conference required that the motion to vacate be denied. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff bank's unexcused failure to appear at a scheduled conference required denial of the bank's motion to vacate a default judgment. The court said, although CPLR 3215C was not an appropriate ground upon which to dismiss the complaint, because the plaintiff initiated proceedings for the entry of a judgment by moving for an order of reference within 1 year of defendant's default, dismissal of the complaint was appropriate pursuant to 22 New York Code of Rules and Regulations, section 202.27C, since the plaintiff failed to appear for a scheduled October 2012 conference. A plaintiff seeking to vacate a default in appearing at a conference is required to demonstrate both a reasonable excuse for its default and a potentially meritorious cause of action, citing CPLR 5015, subdivision A1. Although the determination of whether an excuse is reasonable is committed to the sound discretion of the motion court, the defaulting party must submit evidence in admissible form establishing both a reasonable excuse and a potentially meritorious cause of action. Next is the City Mortgage case, pages 26 and 27, another foreclosure case, this time dealing with the required proof of notice pursuant to Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law 1304, and also the required proof of standing that a bank must present. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, determined that plaintiff bank in this foreclosure action did not demonstrate compliance with the notice requirements of Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, section 1304, and did not demonstrate it had standing based upon a merger to foreclose. The court wrote, the plaintiff failed to demonstrate its strict compliance with Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law 1304. The plaintiff did not submit an affidavit of service or proof of mailing by the U.S. Postal Service evidencing that the plaintiff properly served the defendant pursuant to RPAPL 1304. Instead, the plaintiff relied upon the affidavit of its employee, Lisa Duddy, a vice president of document control. In her affidavit, Duddy averred that her review of records maintained by the plaintiff revealed that the plaintiff sent 90-day notices by registered or certified mail and first-class mail to each of the defendants, and she described a correspondence log that purportedly evidenced those mailings. While mailing may be proved by documents meeting the requirements of the business records exception to the rule against hearsay, here the plaintiff failed to submit a copy of the correspondence log in support of its motion. Consequently, the statements in Duddy's affidavit regarding the correspondence log are inadmissible hearsay and lack probative value. The plaintiff did not establish proof of a standard office practice and procedure designed to ensure that items are properly addressed and mailed. With respect to the standing issue, the court wrote, we note that the plaintiff also failed to submit sufficient evidence in admissible form of a merger with the plaintiff to establish that the plaintiff was the holder of the note at the time of the commencement of the action. Next is the Errant Therapeutics case on page 28. It has to do with the pleading requirements for fraud and civil conspiracy. First Department, modifying Supreme Court, held that although there is no cause of action for civil conspiracy in New York, the conspiracy alleged here was validly pled as part of the fraud cause of action. The court wrote, civil conspiracy is not recognized as an independent tort in this state. Rather, the allegations in the complaint, herein charging conspiracy, are deemed part of the remaining causes of action to which they are relevant. Here, the conspiracy charge remains as part of the fraud cause of action. Liability for fraud may be premised on knowing participation in a scheme to defraud, even if that participation does not by itself suffice to constitute fraud. Allegations of conspiracy serve to enable a plaintiff to connect a defendant with the acts of his co-conspirators, where without it he could not be implicated. Plaintiff sufficiently alleges overt acts. The liability of a defendant as a conspirator for co-conspirators' wrongful acts does not necessarily depend upon his active participation in the particular overt acts. Moreover, once a conspiracy is established, all defendants are liable for each other's acts in furtherance of the conspiracy. Next is the DidIt.com case. It's on page 30. It's another fraud case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion to dismiss the fraud cause of action should not have been granted. Supreme Court held the fraud action was duplicative of the breach of contract action. The court wrote, the cause of action alleging fraudulent inducement was not duplicative of the breach of contract cause of action. The first cause of action alleges that the defendants knowingly made false representations in financial statements, which were collateral to the asset purchase agreement. That these false statements were made in order to induce the plaintiff to enter the asset purchase agreement, that the plaintiff would not have entered into the asset purchase agreement but for these false statements, and that the plaintiff was injured by the fraudulent conduct. As the first cause of action alleges misrepresentations of present fact that were collateral to the asset purchase agreement and further alleges that these misrepresentations induced the plaintiff to enter the asset purchase agreement, the court should have denied that branch of the defendant's motion. Next is matter of Joan H.H. on page 31. It has to do with the power of a judge to resettle an order. Third Department, reversing family court, held the court was without authority to issue a resettled order which substantially changed the original order. The original order, which was issued in the absence of testimony, provided that mother's mental health and substance abuse problems be monitored by the Monroe County Probation Department. The department declined because it doesn't handle custody matters. Family court then issued a resettled order requiring mental health and substance abuse treatment for mother and allowing grandmother access to the mother's medical records. The court wrote, resettlement of an order is a procedure designed solely to correct errors or omissions as to form or for clarification. It may not be used to effect a substantive change in or to amplify the prior decision of the court. That's CPLR 2221. Family court's resettled order does effect a substantive change and was beyond the court's authority to issue. The underlying petition included serious substance abuse and mental health allegations, but at no point was any actual testimony taken. Next is a Deutsche Bank National Trust Company case, page 32. It's another case that involves the authority of a judge, this time in a foreclosure case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the judge should not have, sua sponte, denied plaintiff bank's motion for summary judgment in this foreclosure action on the ground the bank did not establish standing. The bank need not affirmatively demonstrate standing absent the defendant's assertion that the bank lacked standing. Here the defendant did not address the bank's standing in his answer and did not oppose the motion for summary judgment. The court wrote, the defendant did not raise the issue of standing by asserting lack of standing as an affirmative defense in his answer or moving to dismiss the complaint on that ground in a pre-answer motion to dismiss. Inasmuch as the defendant failed to raise the issue, it was inappropriate for the Supreme Court to sua sponte do so on the defendant's behalf. The issue of standing was not properly before the Supreme Court. Next is matter of Velez, page 33, another case involving the authority of a court, of a judge. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that Supreme Court should not have, sua sponte, granted relief which was not requested by a party. Petitioner allegedly was injured trying to board a subway train. Before filing a notice of claim, petitioner commenced a CPLR 3102C proceeding to obtain discovery before starting the action. The court granted the petition and sua sponte gave the petitioner permission to amend the notice of claim, which had not yet been filed, within 30 days of filing the note of issue. The Second Department noted that a sua sponte order is not appealable, but it exercised its discretion to grant leave to appeal pursuant to CPLR 5701 Subdivision A2 and Subdivision C. The court wrote, turning to the merits, pursuant to CPLR 2214A, an order to show cause must state the relief demanded and the grounds therefor. However, the court may grant relief that is warranted by the facts plainly appearing on the papers on both sides, if the relief granted is not too dramatically unlike the relief sought. The proof offered supports it, and there's no prejudice to any party. Here, the Supreme Court strayed from this principle when, in addition to granting, in effect, that branch of the petition which was for an order preserving material related to the accident, it also, sua sponte, granted a nearly unlimited prospective right to the petitioner to amend a notice of claim that had not yet been served. This sua sponte relief was dramatically different from the pre-action discovery that was the subject of the petition. Next case is on page 34, Greenbacker Residential Solar. It's a case where the court found a lack of personal jurisdiction over one of the defendants. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, determined defendant, that's Sprinkle's motion to dismiss the complaint for lack of personal jurisdiction should have been granted, noting that Sprinkle's only connection with the corporation alleged to have breached the contract was his salary. The corporation's contacts with New York could not, therefore, be imputed to Sprinkle. The court wrote, the complaint fails to state a cause of action as against Sprinkle for tortious interference with contract because there's no allegation that Sprinkle personally benefited from the corporation's alleged breach of contract. The only benefit he is alleged to have received is his salary from the corporations. Plaintiff failed to make a sufficient start on showing of jurisdiction over Sprinkle to entitle it to jurisdictional discovery because the conduct complained of involved a diversion of funds from outside New York to recipients outside New York. The critical events, and thus the situs of the injury, were not in New York. Moreover, plaintiff does not allege that Sprinkle received substantial revenue from interstate or international commerce. And that's citing CPLR 302, subdivision A32. Because Sprinkle did not personally benefit from the breach of contract, the corporation's contacts with New York cannot be imputed to him. Nor can Sprinkle be said to have reasonably expected his actions to have consequences in New York, as he neither did anything to avail himself of New York, nor took any steps to project himself into New York. Given that Sprinkle had no contact with New York and did not purposefully avail himself of New York, the constitutional guarantee of due process bars New York courts from exercising personal jurisdiction over him. Next is City Mortgage on page 35. It deals with the law of the case. First Department, reversing Supreme Court in this foreclosure action, held that a deed made under false pretenses was void ab initio, and therefore the related mortgage was invalid. The court noted that the law of the case doctrine does not prohibit it from reconsidering a matter where there is subsequent evidence affecting the prior determination. The court simply said, the law of the case doctrine does not limit our power to reconsider issues where there are extraordinary circumstances such as subsequent evidence affecting the prior determination. Next, on pages 35 and 36, it's the Cruzan versus Moss case. It has to do with governmental immunity. This was a defamation action. Third Department determined statements posted on an election-related Facebook page by defendant, a sheriff running for county executive, concerning plaintiff, a deputy county executive also running for county executive, were actionable in this defamation case. The court noted that the defendant's appeal of the denial of his motion to strike certain paragraphs of the complaint was not before the court because a motion for leave to appeal had not been made. The court wrote, "We reject defendant's contention that he is shielded from liability due to absolute immunity. This immunity protects government officials such as defendant with respect to statements made during the discharge of those responsibilities about matters which come within the ambit of those duties. As such, plaintiff cannot maintain a defamation claim against defendant based upon statements emanating from official reports and communications. Although defendant was commenting about an investigation being conducted by his office, as well as responding to attacks on the credibility of his office, the documentary evidence in the record establishes that the challenged statements were not posted on the official site of the Chemung County Sheriff. Rather, they were posted on defendant's campaign Facebook page and another internet website. Under these circumstances, defendant cannot rely on absolute immunity. The statement that plaintiff was pilfering free gas from taxpayers is susceptible to a defamatory meaning inasmuch as it conveys, at a minimum, serious impropriety and, at worst, criminal behavior. Such statement also has a precise meaning that is capable of being proven true or false. The complaint alleged that defendant published the false statements and that they were made in bad faith with reckless disregard for the truth and tended to subject plaintiff to public contempt, ridicule, aversion, and disgrace. In view of these allegations, as well as the specific statements at issue, we are satisfied that plaintiff sufficiently pleaded malice." Next is J.P. Morgan Chase Bank. It's on pages 36 and 37. It deals with the need to record a copy of a mortgage with the county clerk's office because the original had allegedly been lost. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff bank was entitled to an order requiring the county clerk to accept a copy of a mortgage for recording, and the original was allegedly lost and had never been recorded. The Second Department further held that an attorney affidavit was an appropriate vehicle for the submission of the documents to be recorded, which were in admissible form. The court wrote, "Plaintiff established its prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law on the first cause of action, which sought an order directing the Suffolk County Clerk to accept a copy of the mortgage for recording. The county clerk has a statutory duty that is ministerial in nature to record a written conveyance if it is duly acknowledged and accompanied by the proper fee." That's Real Property Law, Section 290, Subdivision 3, also Section 291, County Law, Section 525.1. Accordingly, the clerk does not have the authority to refuse to record a conveyance which satisfies the narrowly drawn prerequisite set forth in the recording statute. Here, the copy of the mortgage submitted on the motion, which is notarized, was subject to recording. Contrary to the Supreme Court's determination, the complaint adequately stated a cause of action for this relief, and the plaintiff's failure to submit an affidavit of someone with personal knowledge of the facts was not fatal to the motion. The affidavit or affirmation of an attorney, even if he or she has no personal knowledge of the facts, may serve as the vehicle for the submission of acceptable attachments which provide evidentiary proof in admissible form, such as documents and transcripts. At this point, I'm going to insert a verification code for this July 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE. The affirmation code is County Clerk. Again, the affirmation code for this July 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE is County Clerk. Next is the Kahn case on pages 37 and 38. It's another municipal law case. It has to do with the adequacy of a notice of claim. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the complaint against the municipal defendants could not be amended to assert a derivative cause of action by plaintiff decedent's mother. The court wrote, "The decedent died on August 7, 2016. Subsequently, the decedent's mother, Marilyn, an administrator of decedent's estate, moved for leave to substitute herself as the plaintiff in place of the decedent. She also moved for leave to amend the complaint and add a cause of action to recover damages for wrongful death on behalf of the decedent's estate, and in effect, a derivative cause of action to recover damages for loss of services on her own behalf in her individual capacity. The notices of claim filed with the city and the Port Authority were limited to allegations that as a result of the accident, the decedent was caused to sustain damages related to his personal injuries, loss of earnings, pain and suffering, and medical expenses. Marilyn was not identified as a claimant in the caption of these notices. She was not mentioned in the text of the notices of claim, and there were no allegations that she individually sustained any damages for which compensation was sought from the city or the Port Authority. Supreme Court should have denied that branch of Maryland's motion, which was in effect for leave to amend the complaint to assert a derivative cause of action to recover damages for loss of services on her behalf. Next is matter of Liliana K. on page 38. It's a family court case, and it involves the issue of collateral estoppel based on a criminal conviction. Third Department held petitioner's motion for summary judgment, and this neglect proceeding was properly granted. The motion was based in part on respondents endangering the welfare of a child conviction. The court wrote, a criminal conviction may be given collateral estoppel effect in a family court proceeding where, one, the identical issue has been resolved, and two, the defendant in the criminal action had a full and fair opportunity to litigate the issue of his or her criminal conduct. Next is the Noel B. case on page 39. It has to do with privilege in a medical malpractice action. Fourth Department reversing Supreme Court over a concurrence and refusing to follow the Second Department held certain statements made in connection with the hospital's, that's SUNY Upstate's, quality assurance investigation were privileged pursuant to the education law and the public health law, and therefore were not subject to discovery in the medical malpractice action. The court wrote, the New York State education law shields from disclosure the proceedings and records relating to performance of a medical or a quality assurance review function or participation in a medical and dental malpractice prevention program. That's Public Health Law, Section 2805-M, Subdivision 2. Although there's an exception to that privilege, the exception is narrow and is limited to statements made by any person in attendance at such a quality assurance meeting who is a party to an action or proceeding, the subject matter of which was reviewed at that meeting. That's Education Law Section 65273 and Public Health Law Section 2805-M, Subdivision 2. Here the statements at issues were provided shortly after the incident and were obtained as part of SUNY Upstate's quality assurance investigation. The statements, however, were not made at a quality assurance committee meeting, nor were they made in response to any inquiries initiated by the committee. None of the defendants appeared at any committee meeting. Next is the Sarin case on page 40. It's another privilege case, this time dealing with attorney-client privilege. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that emails which had inadvertently been provided to the plaintiff were not protected by attorney-client privilege. Therefore, Supreme Court should not have granted a protective order pursuant to CPLR 3101, Subdivision B. The court wrote, the defendants failed to meet their burden of establishing a right to protection of the subject emails. The communications relate to the business of the defendants rather than legal issues, and nothing stated by in-house counsel in the emails sets him apart as a legal advisor in the discussion. The affidavits of the defendant's CEO and in-house counsel submitted in support of the cross motion merely state in a conclusory manner that the communications were confidential and privileged. The defendants point to no particular communication in which in-house counsel gave legal advice or in which the defendant's other employees sought legal advice from in-house counsel. Next is Eltingville Lutheran Church on pages 40 and 41. It has to do with the jurisdiction of courts over religious controversies. Second Department held three causes of action in a lawsuit brought by a church, that's Eltingville, against the synod and its bishop, stemming from the synod's decision to place a school owned and operated by Eltingville under its control, were not justiciable in state courts because of the constitutional separation of church and state. The court wrote, the complaint challenged the synod's determination to impose synodical administration upon Eltingville, the church. Such a determination could only be made upon finding that the membership of a congregation has become so scattered and so diminished in numbers as to make it impractical for such a congregation to fulfill the purposes for which it was organized, or that it is necessary for the synod to protect the congregation's property from waste and deterioration. And it cites the synod's constitution and religious corporations law, section 17-C. A synod's determination to impose synodical administration on a local church is a non-justiciable religious determination. Next is Bayview Loan Servicing, which is on page 42. It has to do with sanctions imposed upon a party and the requirement that sanctions be supported by a written decision. Fourth Department held plaintiff loan company waived the time of the essence provision in this foreclosure sale to the highest bidder, Fox, by its relentless attempts to prevent the sale from going forward to exact a higher purchase price. The Fourth Department noted that the sanctions imposed upon plaintiff were not supported by a written decision, as required by 22 New York Code of Rules and Regulations, section 130-1.1, and remanded for compliance with that regulation. The court wrote, we conclude that plaintiff's conduct was completely without merit in law and cannot be supported by a reasonable argument for an extension, modification, or reversal of existing law, and was undertaken primarily to delay or prolong the resolution of litigation. Nevertheless, we conclude that the court erred in failing to comply with 22 New York Code of Rule and Regulations, section 130-1.2, because it failed to set forth in a written decision the conduct on which the imposition of sanctions is based, the reasons why the court found the conduct to be frivolous, and the reasons why the court found the amount imposed to be appropriate. We therefore modify the order by vacating the fourth ordering paragraph, and we remit the matter to Supreme Court for compliance with 22 NYCRR, section 130-1.2. Next is on page 43, Wilmington Savings Fund Society. It has to do with the criteria for an extension of time to serve a party. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff bank in this foreclosure action should have been granted more time to serve the defendant by publication. The court wrote, pursuant to CPLR 306-B, a court may, in the exercise of discretion, grant a motion for an extension of time within which to effect a service upon good cause shown or in the interest of justice. To establish good cause, a plaintiff must demonstrate reasonable diligence in attempting service. Good cause will not exist where a plaintiff fails to make any effort at service or fails to make at least a reasonably diligent effort at service. By contrast, good cause may be found to exist where the plaintiff's failure to timely serve process is a result of circumstances beyond plaintiff's control. If a plaintiff fails to establish good cause for an extension, courts must consider whether an extension is warranted in the interest of justice. A showing of reasonably diligent efforts at service is not required, but courts may consider diligence along with other factors, including the expiration of the statute of limitations, the meritorious nature of the action, the length of the delay, the promptness of a request by plaintiff for an extension, and prejudice to the defendant. Next is the Wolf Props Association, or Associates, case on page 44. It has to do with service of orders. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held an order that was not served on the defendant by the plaintiff. Here it was an order striking the answer if discovery demands were not complied with by a specified date, was not enforceable. The court wrote, the plaintiff as the successful moving party, given that the Supreme Court conditionally granted that branch of the prior motion, which was to strike the defendant's answer, was required to serve the May 2016 order on the defendant for that order to be enforceable against the defendant with respect to its answer being stricken in the event it failed to provide discovery by June 17, 2016. The plaintiff's contention that since the May 2016 order did not specify that the plaintiff had to serve a copy of that order with notice of entry upon the defendant, the plaintiff did not have to do so before that order was enforceable against the defendant is without merit, and it cites CPLR 2220. Next is matter of Barber on pages 44 and 45. It has to do with non-party subpoenas. Fourth Department reversing Supreme Court held the petition to quash a non-party subpoena in this out-of-state asbestos-related insurance action should not have been granted. The court said CPLR 3101, subdivision A4, allows a party to obtain discovery from a non-party and provides that there shall be full disclosure of all matter, material, and necessary in the prosecution or defense of an action, regardless of the burden of proof. The phrase material and necessary in CPLR 3101 must be interpreted liberally to require disclosure upon request of any facts bearing on the controversy, which will assist preparation for trial by sharpening the issues and reducing delay and prolixity. An application to quash a subpoena should be granted only where the futility of the process to uncover anything legitimate is inevitable or obvious, or where the information sought is utterly irrelevant to any proper inquiry, and the burden is on the party seeking to quash the subpoena to make that showing. A witness's sworn denial of any relevant knowledge is insufficient standing alone to establish the discovery sought is utterly irrelevant to the action, or that the subpoena, if honored, will obviously and inevitably fail to turn up relevant evidence. Next is the Frank case. On pages 45 and 46, it has to do with the conversion of a motion to a summary judgment motion. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, noted that Supreme Court properly dispensed with notice when it converted a motion to dismiss to a motion for summary judgment on a contractual interpretation issue, and further noted the difference between non-competition agreements in the employment context and in the sale of a business context. Here, defendant sold his business, including goodwill, to plaintiff, and then was employed by plaintiff. The court wrote, although the court is normally required to give notice to the parties before converting a motion to dismiss to one for summary judgment, the court properly dispensed with statutory notice here, inasmuch as the issue presented rested entirely upon the construction and interpretation of an unambiguous contractual provision that exclusively involved issues of law which were fully appreciated and argued by the parties. Because plaintiff sold his business to defendant, including the goodwill, the enforceability of the restrictive covenants must be evaluated pursuant to the standard applicable to the sale of a business, rather than the stricter standard of reasonableness applicable to employment contracts. It is well settled that a covenant restricting the right of a seller of a business to compete with the buyer is enforceable if its duration and scope are reasonably necessary to protect the buyer's legitimate interest in the purchased asset. Next is the Castro case on page 46. It's interesting because the appellate court, at reviewing a summary judgment proceeding, found that the plaintiff's testimony about how this traffic accident happened was incredible as a matter of law. First Department, over an extensive dissent, held the defendant's motion for summary judgment in this traffic accident case was properly granted. The majority argued plaintiff's testimony was incredible and therefore was properly disregarded. The dissent argued plaintiff's testimony raised classic questions of fact about how the accident happened. The collision occurred when plaintiff was attempting to change lanes. The majority interpreted plaintiff's testimony to mean that she was straddling two lanes and was not moving when the truck struck her SUV, which, based on photographic evidence the majority found incredible as a matter of law. The court wrote, in summary judgment analysis, we must discount the plaintiff's testimony where the plaintiff has relied solely on her own testimony, uncorroborated by any other witnesses or evidence, and her testimony belied common sense. As these circumstances are presented in this case, plaintiff's testimony was properly disregarded as being without evidentiary value. Thus, plaintiff's testimony raised no triable issues of fact. That completes this CLE, which is based on the decisions released in July of 2019 addressing civil procedure issues, and the summaries of those decisions, which were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in July of 2019.